Hello and welcome back to the RHS Gardening Podcast. I'm Guy Barter, Chief Horticulturist at the Royal Horticultural Society. As regular listeners will know, in this podcast we bring you gardening features, seasonal advice and tips from RHS experts throughout the gardening year. June is a time of abundance in the garden, especially for those of us who grow fruit and vegetables. The first strawberries are ripening. Gooseberries can be gathered now as they come up to ripeness for making jam and for preserving. Rhubarb, of course, is still being pulled at this season, and it's the very last pickings for the asparagus before giving it a rest until next year. In June, the days are long, the sun is high in the sky, and it's peak light conditions, so that any plants sown or planted out now are going to get off to a flying start, not least because the soil is still moist from winter rains. Unfortunately, it's also peak weed season. At this time of year, a good deal of effort has to be put in just to knock the weeds on the head so that you can sit back in July and August and enjoy the fruits of your labours. So, coming up in this summer edition, location, 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 or rather relocation. How can you safely move treasured plants from one garden to another? We speak to award-winning designers at this year's Chelsea Flower Show to find out how to transplant safely. RHS advisors tackle your gardening questions, and as always, the latest news on RHS garden events across the UK. But first, let's hear about some of the key jobs you can be tackling in your garden this month.
Hi, it's Bernard Boardman from the fruit team at Wisley. Actually, we've just renamed ourselves Edibles, so we're now the Edibles team at Wisley. I'm looking at our fruit, and it's June, and I'm thinking about ordering cream because the strawberries are growing nicely. But just keep an eye on your soft fruit. It's a great time of year for anything that wants to eat or damage soft fruit. So be aware of aphids, and I'll let you decide what you want to do about them. We try and spray as little as possible, but sometimes you have to. And it's very careful, if you do resort to that, that you make sure that you're using the right sort of spray intervals between spraying and then harvesting your fruit. Make sure your raspberries and gooseberries, that it's all well supported. You sort of tighten wires up in the winter when there's very little growth on plants. You think, yeah, that'll be fine. And then suddenly they've got all their leaves on, so it's like a galleon in full sail, and then the fruit comes on and that's more weight. So just make sure that everything's as it should be, because it's a great time of year for support posts to break, and you can often sort of tuck a spare post down the side of the one that's doing the main job just to act as a little bit of extra support if you need to. Looking at the bigger trees, your apples and pears, we've had the delights of blossom time, and now we can see that there's lots of young fruit developing, and now you have to harden your heart and start and take a good percentage of that young fruit off, just to open up the clusters, let there be plenty of air and light, and the air circulation is absolutely vital, and it also lets the sunlight in, so fruit can ripen and develop properly. You can take apples off, and then there is the delightful thing that nature throws at us called the June drop. Nature does this thinning, and we would thin some more. So with an eating apple, we'd go down to sort of try and leave them at sort of two per cluster, and you may well have started off with half a dozen. With a cooking apple, you just want those down to single fruits. You may have planted young trees in the winter time. It's absolutely crucial that you make sure that they're well watered throughout the summer, because if we hit a long spell of dry weather, they will stop their root development, and that can sort of have a detrimental effect on their establishment. So just be mindful, keep an eye on things. They don't have to be soaking wet, but if we do have a prolonged spell, give them a good drink, sort of at least once a week.
Remember, you can find more information on all aspects of gardening techniques on our website's advice pages. Go to rhs.org.uk/advice. I'm Guy Barter, and you're listening to the RHS Gardening Podcast. As regular listeners will know, each month we're joined by the RHS Gardening Advice Team, who will answer some of the questions we've received recently. Members of the RHS can get advice on any gardening problem for free all through the year from our expert team. Questions can be submitted by phone, post or email, or in person at any of the RHS flower shows. And podcast listeners can also email us your questions directly to podcast@rhs.org.uk. So let's join my colleagues as they discuss some of the inquiries they have received recently.
I'm Jenny Bowden and I'm one of the horticultural advisors.
My name's Anna Platoni and I'm an entomologist.
My name's Rob Sterling and I'm one of the advisors. Harry Gaines emails us saying he's having problems with pigeons, and he says, how can I best protect my plants and keep them off my cabbages? They seem to be able to ruin plants in seconds. Anna.
Yeah, this is a really common problem, especially with plants such as cabbages. Pigeons absolutely love them, and yeah, they can cause a lot of damage very quickly. And the annoying thing is once they've found an area that they like to feed in with lots of food, they'll quite often keep returning. There are plenty of different options. Some of them work better than others. So you can go for perhaps traditional sort of bird scaring devices, things like hanging CDs up. The light reflecting off them should cause them some sort of dismay. Problem is the pigeons, when there's a really good food source there, and they can very quickly get used to all these bird scaring devices. There are also some proprietary things you can buy from garden centres to spray onto areas which should make the foliage taste nasty to the pigeons, but these can be washed off very quickly, especially in wet weather, so they often have to be reapplied so often that it's not necessarily worth the work. The only sort of foolproof way to keep pigeons off will be to put some strong netting or a wire cage over the cabbages. I'm afraid that's the best bet.
I tend to use insect-proof mesh because it keeps off many pests that love to feed on cabbage family crops, and it also keeps off the pigeons very comprehensively. But it is rather expensive. However, on a small scale, it's affordable and saves you an awful lot of work and time.
Roger Delaney in Berkshire asks about squirrels. How can I stop these hungry creatures digging up my bulbs? It happens year after year and is driving me nuts. So again, a really annoying problem that's quite difficult to solve. Squirrels absolutely love eating bulbs. And again, the only real way to completely protect them is to put to cover the bulbs. So if you're growing bulbs in pots, this can be easier to put a wire mesh over the top. In a lawn, it's almost impossible, and there are very few ways to really keep squirrels out of your garden completely. The good news, I guess, is that squirrels tend to be inquisitive feeders, and really the first year you plant the bulbs are the years that they're going to try and dig them up. If your bulbs make it through that first year, chances are they've got a much better chance against the squirrels, but getting them through that first year is the hardest thing.
I had problems with squirrels biting through the base of lily stems one year, not actually eating them, but literally just doing it for fun, biting them off at ground level, and there were these spikes of lilies just laying on the ground, completely doomed. And I did put a basket over them the following year, just, to see if that would actually put them off. So, the basket was probably about 6 inches or 15 centimetres high, I suppose, once it was inverted. And it seemed to deter their interest until they were such a size that they'd forgotten about them. So whether that worked or whether they decided that it was just boring fun doing it again, I'm not sure. But I did try that and it seemed to work.
An Espire of Welland Garden City writes in to say, how can I propagate my carnations? Carnations, of course, are a lovely showy flower, much grown for buttonholes and florist arrangements, but are also a wonderful and easy thing to grow in the gardens. Have you got any ideas on this?
Well, one of the ways of propagating carnations is via a method called taking pips, which are pieces of stem which are quite young. They're still green and soft. And if you hold on to the mature part of the stem, which is the older part of the stem, and just pull away a piece of unflowered stem from the top, it snaps and you're left with a little piece of stem, probably about, say, something like 10 centimetres or 4 inches long. And if you take off the lower leaves, put those into a potting mix of about 50-50 multi-purpose and sharp sand, they seem to root very easily.
We've got a question here from Mr. F. Raven in Guildford, who says, I'd like some bamboo to create a screen around my sitting area and introduce height and movement into the garden. But he's particularly worried about it running rampant and taking over the garden. How can he prevent this from happening? Is there any way to restrict its growth, or are there varieties that are slightly less invasive? Yes, it's all a bit deceptive, because sometimes there are bamboos which are sold as what they call clumpers rather than runners, and they are not quite accurate sometimes. I think we're getting round to it. But things like Philostachys, for example, Philostachys is the black includes the black stem bamboo, and they can be clumpers for a while, so they make a nice clump basically, and they stay put for many, many years, and they'll make a quite a nice colony of canes, which you can thin so that you can see through them, but you know, quite a large clump. But then after about 10 years maybe, or if they get especially dry, and they may then start to go off looking for somewhere else to live, so suddenly they'll start to take off, and that's when you're in trouble. So they can be civilized for many, many years and then suddenly take off, which is obviously a great problem to neighbours, and you know, even to the person who planted it in the first place. There is a group which is more of a clumper than a runner, which is a Fargesia, which is spelt with an F, F-A-R-G-E-S-I-A. They get to around 10 to 12 feet, so around the 4 metre size. You've still got that lovely sound as they wave in the breeze, and they're well worth planting. You can plant bamboos in containers, but they're so vigorous and so hungry that you have to really keep an eye on the watering and be ready to divide them quite regularly. Otherwise, you might find you've even got a cracked pot because they're just trying to explode out. So you'd probably, you know, you'd be looking at a container which is, you know, 45 centimetres deep by 45 centimetres wide. That's 18 inches each way. And just realise that you're going to have to be knocking them out and really maintaining them quite a lot. You can't just plant them up and forget about them and hope they're going to do that wonderful job without quite a lot of care. There are ways of containing them within the garden. And Rob, how would you do that?
Yes, you need to use a specialist membrane. It's actually called a bamboo membrane. And you can get that. If you Google it online, you'll probably find that there are some suppliers who would be able to sell it to you by per metre. What you need to do is to install this bamboo membrane at planting time. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to do it after you've decided that the bamboo is beginning to run. It's far too late then. The horse has already bolted, as it were. So at planting time, dig a much larger hole than you would normally need to plant the bamboo in, and probably about 2 to 3 feet across, I would say, to allow the bamboo eventually to grow into to the space, and line the wall of the hole, not the base, but line the wall of the hole with this bamboo membrane. It would be worth trying to excavate as deep as you can, perhaps down to 2 feet or so. And also it's important to put the membrane above the surface of the soil by about 5 centimetres or 2 inches, and then to fill back with good, rich topsoil. It will give you the appearance of a sort of a black ring around in the garden once it's been completely filled back in. And then you can plant your bamboo into that. And the bamboo membrane has a special property which prevents the culms or the new shoots on the rhizomes from actually pushing through. Instead, it resists it, and the bamboo is contained within the area that you've designated. And the 2-inch or 5-centimeter lip on the surface of the soil will also prevent, or at least delay, the bamboo from climbing over the top. Sometimes its rhizomes can come up to the surface and then go along the surface of the soil. And in which case, you know, with that, you would be able to see them before they became well-rooted and prune them off with some secateurs. And that way you can keep even the most troublesome bamboos under control. Mr. Phipps from Farnham writes in and says, my garden is on a steep slope. I've recently created two beds that I'd like to plant up into herbaceous borders. I'm concerned about how to ensure the young plants get enough water. When it rains, the water seems to run off the slope. Do I need to create an irrigation system? Or I don't have a large budget, so is it a lost cause?
Terracing would be the answer here, but I see the budget is limited, so we're going to have to rule out terracing. And instead, there's a number of things you can do, one of which is autumn planting, so that the plants grow, or do at least some of their growing, over the winter while the soil is dry, and in the spring before it takes off. A cunning ruse that people do is to fill a plastic bag with water, make a little hole and stand it next to a newly planted thing so the water seeps out and doesn't run down the slope. If your funds will run to it, then a drip line running along the slope, not up and down, is an excellent solution. If it runs up and down, more water comes out at the bottom and the top, so it has to follow the contours. You can dimple the surface, which is just leave it very slightly dimpled without doing too much disruption. You always best to plant small things, which should save money as well. Finally, you can also get a coir or coconut fibre mat, which you can lay on the slope and plant through that. And that keeps the weeds down and to some extent absorbs the moisture and stops the runoff. So it's by no means impossible to plant a steep slope with perennial plants. But Jenny, you seem to be bursting to say something.
I do have quite a steep slope at home, and budget wouldn't really run to actual terracing, but what I tend to do is just dig into the side of the slope and make individual terraces for each plant, and then enrich each individual hole with some organic matter to help hold on to the moisture, and it works extremely well, and I hand water it, and then everything will spread out from there. So just localized terracing.
C. Cox asks, can you give me advice on how to choose and grow purple sprouting broccoli, please? My family love it, but it can be very expensive in the shops. Guy?
Well, purple sprouting broccoli is expensive in the shops for three reasons. One is it takes 9 months to grow, so it uses up land for a long time. The other is that when you pick it, it wilts and goes horrid very quickly, so it has to be very carefully handled by commercial growers. However, it's easy to grow at home if you can afford leaving the ground tied up for 9 months. The first thing is to choose your kind. There's early and late sprouting selections, which are very cheap seed that you can buy 1,000 or more seeds for £1 or £2. And there's more modern ones that have names like Cardinal, Claret and Bordeaux that give a higher quality at a defined season. And don't forget white broccoli. If you're going to grow your own, you can have some white broccoli, which isn't often available in shops anyway. So it's easy to grow. You sow the seeds in May. You plant out the young plants in July. You can either grow them in a seed bed or in pots, whatever suits. They need minimal feeding or else they get soft and die in the winter. They do need plenty of water. And you plant the plants out about 60 centimetres or 24 inches between the plants, and in rows 75 centimetres apart. That's 20 inches. And that's all there is to it, except, of course, that broccoli is a demon for pests. We've already talked about pigeons, but it's also afflicted by some other things. So I think we really need some input from an entomologist here. Anna, what do you think?
So two types of butterfly are probably the main pests that affect brassicas. They're all called cabbage white butterflies, but there are two species within that, the large white and the small white, and they have caterpillars that will eat purple sprouting broccoli, among with other things in the family. The best way to protect your crop against these is to put some insect-proof netting around and over the crop. The important things to remember when you're doing this is to put them out early enough so that the butterflies haven't had a chance to lay their eggs before you get the netting out. And also to make sure that the crop isn't touching the netting. If it is, then the butterflies can land on the netting and lay their eggs through. That's easier said than done sometimes as the crop grows, as it can grow sort of into the netting that you've carefully placed around it.
The RHS Gardening Advice Team. As well as help with gardening issues, members also get free entry to all four RHS gardens, plus the opportunity to buy priority tickets to our flower shows and events. You can find out more about the benefits of becoming a member on our website, rhs.org.uk/join. Here's a few of the attractions and events coming up in the next few weeks. Harlow Carr is even more plant mad than normal this month, with a bonsai show on the 18th and 19th and a peony show on the 26th of June. Both events are free with normal garden admission. Feel the buzz of summer with our Plants for Wildlife workshop at Hyde Hall on June 23rd. Learn which plants to select and turn your garden into a haven for wildlife. Booking is essential and discounted places are available for RHS members. RHS Garden Rosemore is hosting a new month-long Rose Festival, which centres around the colour and scent of our two rose gardens, consistently voted among the top 10 places in Britain to enjoy roses. Join us for advice, tours and demonstrations and more, including a club craft market and plant centre event on the 18th and 19th of June. As part of National Insect Week, discover details of insects hidden to the naked eye with our entomologists, who will be on hand at Wisley between the 23rd and 26th of June to help you find out more and answer your questions. See our website for timings. It's free with normal garden entry. And finally, don't forget, tickets to our brand new flower show in 2017 at Chatsworth in Derbyshire went on sale on the 7th of June. As an RHS member, you get reduced ticket prices and access on less busy days. Save even more by booking in advance. See rhs.org.uk/chatsworth. And now, here's our Director General, Sue Biggs, to tell us more about this exciting new show.
Chatsworth has got a theme of design revolutionaries, which I think is fantastic. I mean, some great designers like Joseph Paxton, Capability Brown were involved in the creation of that fabulous garden at Chatsworth. But really what we want to do is break the mould of our other flower shows. We want it to be different. So even from as simple as some curved lines instead of straight lines, seeing things from different perspectives, up in the air, crossing over the River Derwent on bridges that we'll have built. Very exciting show it's going to be.
Full details of all events and many more are on our RHS website. Go to rhs.org.uk/eventsearch. One of the questions we're frequently asked by RHS members is how can they move plants from one location to another without harming them? This can be relocation within a garden, as you redesign a border or a seating area, for example, or when moving house. Some of those most experienced in the skills and pitfalls of moving plants are the garden designers who undertake the mammoth task of transporting a huge variety of trees, shrubs and herbaceous perennials to create show gardens at the RHS flower shows. We spoke to some of the award-winning designers at this year's Chelsea Flower Show to hear from the experts about some of the techniques they use when relocating plants safely and some of the useful tricks if you're considering moving house or designing your own garden.
I'm Jo Thompson. I'm garden designer and we're at the Chelsea Flower Show. When I'm talking to clients about moving plants, you know, say they're moving house, I always do suggest that they leave something for the next occupant of the house. It's really easy to take things like geraniums with you. You know, you can split them and leave some and then pot some up and take them with you. I wouldn't try moving anything like a Daphne or peony. Believe me, I've tried to break the walls and it doesn't work. It never works. Irises are good to move. You can split them and take a clump with you and put the rest in the ground for the next occupant. I like to pot up things that have self-sown, so things like fennel. If I see it in the wrong place, I'll just try and either pot it up if I'm moving it to another garden, or just simply plonking it in somewhere else. I mean, I do. I'm a great fan of self-seeders. And things like fennel and Verbena benoriensis work really well. They're very easy to transport. Things like trees, I'd say, it's very complicated to try and move a tree and requires months of preparation. So I would say buy a new one and enjoy watching that one grow.
My name's Cleve West, and we're at the Chelsea Flower Show. From my own experience, I've been able to move things like hollies, quite big hollies, and apple trees, and rhododendrons and box and aces and all that, those sort of plants. They have a really fibrous root ball, so they're quite easy to dig up, as long as you do it in the right time of year, sort of dormant season. Digging up a shrub of any size, as long as it's got a fibrous root system, you can dig round the root ball in the dormant season, and with a bit of muscle power, you probably need several people depending on how big the plant is. But they can usually be moved. It's when you have things like, I've never had any success with mahonias or berberis, that sort of shrub, anything with a much longer root system, meatier root system, they tend not to like it. If you've got any doubt at all, you can always root prune around the shrub or the tree a year before, so they have a chance to grow some more fibrous roots. And we did that with these oak trees, because we knew quite a long time ago we were doing this year. So we had the luxury of being able to root prune them last winter, and so it minimised the stress for this winter. Root pruning does require machinery. If they're large trees, you need a proper tree spade to actually dig round the tree and cut the roots. Doing it yourself by hand is much more labour intensive and can be quite hard work depending on how big or small the tree or shrub is. So you need a bit of energy, a bit of skill.
I'm Chris Beardshaw, and I'm the designer of the Morgan Stanley Garden for Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital. There's always a sense that once you've invested in a plant, you move house, you want to take it with you for whatever reason. And it isn't impossible. You know, the trees that are here, we've got a 9 metre high liriodendron tulipifera, and that is going onto the roof of Great Ormond Street Hospital. It's an undercut tree, so it's been prepared in the nursery for all of its life, actually. It's been undercut on an annual basis and transplanted, and it's then been root balled and air potted. So it's been prepared for that transference. And I think that's the key, is that taking a much loved specimen which hasn't been undercut, where the roots are running across the garden, is very, very difficult. However, if you have the time, a couple of seasons perhaps, and you can dig a trench, you can sever the roots, promote fibrous root growth around the trunk of the tree or the shrub that you're trying to move, and then backfill that trench with sand or compost to then move it when the plant is dormant, you're much more likely for it to succeed. Of course, woody plants are much more difficult than herbaceous perennials, which you can pretty much dig them up and move them in full leaf, and as long as you cut the foliage back and keep them well watered and apologise profusely, they'll be fine.
Designers at this year's Chelsea Flower Show. You can find images and reports from the show on the RHS website. There's also further advice on moving plants and trees on our advice pages. So that's all we have time for in this edition. We'll be back in a fortnight. For now, from me, Guy Barter, and all the RHS Gardening Podcast team, goodbye.